Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Brandon Allgood, the Vice Chair of the Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for this evening. We always welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Professor Alex Filipenko. Alex, an elected member of the National Academy of Sciences, is one of the world's most highly cited astronomers. He is the recipient of numerous prizes for his scientific research and was the only person to have been a member of both teams that revealed the accelerating expansion of the universe. This discovery was deemed the top breakthrough in 1998 by the editors of Science magazine. And it was honored in 2011 with a Nobel Prize in Physics to the team leaders. Winner of the most prestigious teaching awards at UC Berkeley and voted the best professor on campus a record 9 times, he was named National Professor of the Year in 2006. He has produced 5 astronomy video courses with the teaching company, wrote an award-winning astronomy textbook, and appears in numerous television documentaries, including 40 episodes of the Universe series on the History Channel. In 2004, he was awarded the Carl Sagan Prize for Science and Popularization. Tonight, he will be talking to us about dark energy and the runaway universe. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Alex Filipenko.
Well, thank you very much, Brandon, for that very warm introduction, and I thank all of you for being here this evening. This is a wonderful place, and I'm delighted to be able to address you. I wanted to thank my co-sponsor, which is the Friends of Lick Observatory, a relatively new organization for a venerable old institution. The Lick Observatory was established in 1888. It's in the hills to the east of San Jose, and it has had research-grade instruments since that time, and it does lots of public outreach as well. It serves the University of California system, and we train lots of students and postdoctoral scholars there. It's a very, very fun place to visit. You can look through the venerable 36-inch refracting telescope, which at the time that it was built in 1888 was the largest telescope in the world. And I'm very, very proud to be president of the board of the so-called Friends of Lick Observatory, and Brandon is a member of my board. I encourage you to consider joining the Friends of Lick Observatory. You can get a brochure out there when you exit. There are many advantages of becoming a member. You can get special access on some of the evenings to the telescopes, and you're supporting the research and especially the public outreach efforts that we conduct at the observatory. So we're always happy to have the support of the general public. Well, as Brandon said, this work that I'll be discussing tonight was honored with the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics to the team leaders. The team leaders are shown here. Saul Perlmutter of UC Berkeley. Interesting, the green doesn't show up when I point it at the screen, but that's okay, no big deal. Shows up just fine pointing at the walls, but anyway, there's Saul in the middle there. I guess I can use an arrow right here. And then Brian Schmidt of the Australian National University was the leader of the other team, and Adam Rees, who was a member of Schmidt's team, was my postdoctoral scholar at UC Berkeley in the mid to late 1990s when we were making the measurements that led to this discovery. And he was charged with making the measurements, and he wrote the paper for Schmidt's team announcing the results, and so I'm very glad that he was also honored with the prize. There were 48 other people involved in the discovery, and many of us worked very, very hard, and these three gentlemen understand that they wouldn't be where they are right now if it weren't in part for the rest of us. And so they spent part of their prize money flying the rest of us out to participate in Nobel Week in December of 2011, which was just a magnificent week-long party. We got to participate in nearly everything. except for the awarding of the gold medal and the $1 million, okay? So that's a small thing, but anyway, here's the high redshift supernova search team, Brian Schmidt's team, right after the awarding of the prize to Schmidt and Reese. And there we are. It was a wonderful reunion. As Brandon said, I was also at one time a member of Sol Perlmutter's supernova cosmology project, but we decided that we were doing things in a somewhat different fashion, and the way in which I wanted to conduct the work was more similar to that of my astronomer colleagues shown here. So anyway, I switched allegiances. So this work is, of course, astronomical in nature. We're studying the universe, but in particular, we're studying cosmology. Now, cosmology is that subset of astronomy that deals with the structure and evolution of the universe as a whole. So we're interested in truly some of the grandest questions. What is the size of the universe? Is it infinite, or does it wrap around itself somehow? What is its shape? Okay. When was the universe born? This was a big time story. You see that, a big time story. When the universe began. We now know that the universe is 13.7 billion years old. Very old, but not infinitely old. Okay. What will be the fate of the universe far in the future? It's expanding right now. Will it expand forever? Will it someday reverse its motion? This, too, was a big time story. In fact, here you can see the cover of Time magazine in 2011, how the universe will end. They were reporting on our work. At that time, in 2001, we thought we knew how the universe would end. Now, 12 years later, we've done some more research, and we're not quite so sure how it will end. But I will tell you how it might end. Anyway, there really should have been a question mark there. Cosmologists are also interested in the fundamental building blocks of the universe, and those are the galaxies. Now, galaxies are giant collections of hundreds of billions of stars gravitationally bound together in a gigantic structure like this. And our sun is one of hundreds of billions of stars. So we're very small, and we're part of these giant structures. Now, this isn't a picture of our own Milky Way galaxy. This is a different galaxy seen from the outside. If you have a picture like this of the Milky Way, come see me after the talk. I'd like to purchase usage rights, okay? These things aren't rare. Our own Milky Way galaxy is not just one of a few. There are lots and lots of galaxies. And here's one of my favorite photographs from the Hubble Space Telescope. This is part of what's called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. It's a random, typical part of the sky, but a very small part of the sky. Imagine a grain of sand held at arm's length. Do that. Put a grain of sand at arm's length. Imagine how small that looks. That's the fraction of the sky covered in this photograph. And yet, it's filled with galaxies. Almost every single one of these little blobs that you see is another galaxy, not a star in our own galaxy. There are very few stars in our own galaxy in this picture. So you can count them, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's a pretty cushy job. They pay us to sit around and count galaxies, okay? But it would be pretty boring if I were to count them all in this picture. There's several thousand in this picture, and we've taken several such pictures showing that this is representative. So extrapolating over the whole sky, we now know that within the realm of today's great telescopes, there's something like 100 billion galaxies. And that's just in the parts of the universe that we can see. We now have good reasons to believe that the universe is far, far larger than just those parts that we can see. And everywhere there are galaxies. So how do they form? How do they evolve with time? These two are among the central questions of cosmology. So you can see what an exciting field it is, what an exciting subset of astronomy it is. And although I'm an astronomer overall, it's been my privilege to work also in this field of cosmology. And I should mention that our host, Brandon Allgood, got his PhD at UC Santa Cruz working on theoretical aspects of cosmology. Well, among the general public, present company excluded because you're well-educated and you come to Commonwealth Club talks like this, and you probably read a lot. But among the general public, there's considerable confusion between cosmology, the study of the structure and evolution of the universe as a whole, and cosmetology, the study of hairdos and facials. And I admit they sound similar, as do astronomy and astrology, but they are different. They're even spelled differently. Cosmetology is cosmology with an extra E-T in it, like the extraterrestrial, right? I don't know the cosmic significance of that, but write them down. That's how cosmetology differs from cosmology. And you might think that surely I'm joking, you know, there isn't such confusion, but But, you know, I'm a scientist, so I go by evidence, and let me show you some evidence that this is indeed the case. Here's a copy of an ad that a colleague of mine placed in my mailbox last year. Make cosmology your career. Training and supervision in hairstyling, blow drying, permanent waves, coloring and frosting. You laugh, but these are very important topics, okay? Scalp treatments, body and skin care, style cuts, basic cuts. For further information and interviews, call that number. Now, classes started the first Monday in March. So, and this was a few years ago, so you missed them. But probably they'll have this class at your local college and university sometime soon. So if you want to do as I and many of my colleagues have done and get to the cutting edge of this field, so to speak, you should take a class like this. Now, obviously, these guys need a class not only on what their own profession is, but a class on spelling and proofreading, because in addition to foother here, you see hair slying. See that hair slying? And coloring, well, that's the British spelling, and my own thesis advisor was British, so I'll allow that. But maybe their spell checker wasn't working or something. Actually, this is a pretty old ad. It comes from the Pasadena Star News many, many years ago. I don't know that spell checkers existed back then, but they don't even know their own field, okay? By the way, my father-in-law, Gary Edwards, says, you know, Alex, the only real difference between your UC Berkeley course on cosmology and a course on cosmetology is that you don't give makeup exams, you see. So anyway, puns are a highly underappreciated form of humor, but he and I have a very similar form of humor. So, okay. Well, a central figure in this field was Edwin Hubble, after whom, of course, the Hubble Space Telescope is named. And he made a number of important discoveries. The one on which I want to focus tonight is the expansion of the universe. And what he did is he collected data on galaxies, and in particular, he obtained distances of galaxies using a technique I'll describe in a few minutes. And he found that using initially another astronomer's data, that they're all moving away from us, and that the more distant ones, the ones that look smaller and fainter in the sky, are moving away from us faster than the bigger, brighter, more nearby ones. And this motion can be seen from a spectrum, a rainbow of the galaxy. You pass the light through a prism, you decompose the white light into its spectrum of colors, and you see all these dark lines here. Now, those are due to chemical elements in the gases in the relatively cool outer parts of stars of which the galaxies consist. And spectra can tell us all kinds of interesting things about the physics of the objects that we are studying. But in particular, you know, besides chemical composition and stuff like that, you can tell whether an object is moving away from you or toward you. If it's moving away from you, then this pattern of lines, these guys are due to neutral sodium, for example, this is due to hydrogen, they're all shifted toward redder colors, longer wavelengths of light. And if the object is coming toward you, then they're shifted toward shorter wavelengths. And this is similar to the audible Doppler effect that you've heard when a siren is coming toward you. The pitch sounds high because the waves are squished together, and when it's going away from you, the pitch sounds low because they're spread apart. Now, unlike the conventional Doppler effect, which is due to the motion of an object through a pre-existing space, we now know, and this is something that Hubble resisted initially, but we now know that the redshift of galaxies is caused by the actual stretching of space itself. That's different from objects moving through a pre-existing space, okay? This is an actual stretching of space itself. And with the stretching of space, you get a stretching of the light, the electromagnetic radiation, turning initially blue light into red light. That's the origin of this redshift, okay? And so the data implied that the universe is expanding and, and that the more distant galaxies are moving away from us faster than the nearby galaxies because they exhibit a bigger redshift. So if you draw the universe from our perspective, here we are, all the galaxies are moving away, and at a given time, the more distant ones are moving faster than the nearby ones. Space has stretched more. So that's the expansion of the universe. Now let me pause here because there's something a bit strange about this diagram as I've drawn it. What's strange about it? Yeah, we're at the center. Why would that be? Do all these other galaxies not like us? Is it something we said? Do we smell? Are all these other galaxies lactose intolerant? Get it? Milky Way galaxy, lactose intolerant. Oh, yeah, I know. When I talk about cosmology in my introductory astronomy class at Cal, which I'm teaching right now, I say, you know, what's the problem? Are we from Stanford or something? with due apologies from those to those of you who might be Stanford alumni, it is truly an outstanding institution, no doubt about it. It's just not quite as outstanding as Cal. Anyway, no, we don't think that we're in any special position. We think instead that no matter which galaxy we happen to be in, we would see all others moving away from us, except for very nearby galaxies can be gravitationally bound to ours. Don't worry about that. And the point is that this is what you see in any uniformly expanding universe. And a good example is an expanding loaf of raisin bread. So you've got the raisins, which are the galaxies. The galaxies are held together strongly. They're not expanding, by the way. The dough is uniformly filled with yeast, and you let it bake for an hour, and the whole thing stretches. And don't worry about the sides of the bread. The universe is either infinite or wraps around itself. But you can see that this raisin thinks it's at the center, because all the others are moving away. But it calls up its friendly neighboring raisin, and it thinks it's at the center as well, because it sees guys moving away. There is no unique center, at least not in the dimensions that we can probe. Note also that this raisin started out 5 centimeters away. After an hour, it's 10 centimeters away, so it moved 5 centimeters per hour. This one started out 10 centimeters away. After an hour, it's 20, so it moved at 10 centimeters per hour. Bigger distance, bigger speed. The reason for that is that every bit of space expands. So the bigger the amount of space to begin with, the greater the cumulative expansion. That explains Hubble's relationship. So we think that we live in a uniformly expanding universe. Now, with telescopes like the Hubble, we've measured the current rate of expansion. It's just some number. It's a very interesting number, but I don't need to tell you exactly what it is. But the story doesn't end there. And this goes all the way back to Newton. Newton looked at the moon, he watched the apple fall from a tree, and he wondered whether the force causing the apple to fall is somehow related to whatever it is that causes the moon to orbit the Earth. And indeed, he developed his universal law of gravitation and his laws of motion and so on, and he showed that indeed these seemingly disparate phenomena are intimately related. Well, gravity pulls, and so if I toss this apple, the mutual gravitational attraction between the Earth and the apple slows down the apple, brings it to a halt, and then comes crashing back down. Okay? So in a similar way, if the density of the universe is high, that is, if there's a lot of galaxies per unit volume, every unit volume will be pulling on every other unit volume a lot, slowing down this tendency of space to expand, slowing it down so much that eventually the expansion will stop and then reverse itself. So if you say that the universe started with a big bang, it ends with a big crunch. Or you could say big bang, gnab, gib, which is big bang backwards, okay? Big bang, gnab, gib. It ends up being hot and dense and compressed. So here's a universe that was expanding initially, but eventually started collapsing. And you see the whole coordinate grid. It's the space itself that partakes of this expansion, okay? It's not galaxies moving through space. But there's another possibility. Had I eaten my Wheaties this morning, and if there weren't the technical difficulty of a ceiling, I could in principle heave this apple so fast that although Earth's gravity would indeed be slowing it down, it wouldn't slow it down enough to bring it to a halt and then back down to the Earth. It might bring it to a halt as time approaches infinity, or it could be that the apple just keeps on going away at some non-zero speed, even at infinity. Okay? So this is an apple thrown at or greater than Earth's escape velocity. It's about 11 kilometers per second, 6 to 7 miles per second, okay? So, in fact, I can't throw that fast. But in principle, I could, all right? And so in a similar way, if the density of the universe is low, then yes, all the galaxies are pulling on all the other galaxies, slowing down the expansion, but not in such a way that the expansion will ever stop. That would be an eternally expanding universe. The coordinate grid keeps on expanding forever. That would be a very different fate than the Big Crunch universe. This would be a universe that grows ever darker, more dilute, ever colder, whereas the Big Crunch universe gets denser and hotter and more compressed. Okay, so we would like to know the fate of the universe. That's one of the central cosmological questions. Okay, so how might we go about it? Let's go back to the apple, very illustrative example. If I measure the speed of the apple at many different times in its trajectory, and I see that it's been slowing down a lot on its way up, then I can predict that it'll someday stop and come back. If instead it hasn't been slowing down very much, then I can predict that it'll keep on expanding forever. So in a similar way, if I examine the expansion history of the universe, compare the current expansion rate with many times back in the past, I could, in principle, using the observations and the equations, predict the future. That's the idea. Now, we know the current expansion rate, and you might say, well, that's great, but how can we go back into the past? How can we measure the expansion rate as it was long ago, given that we live right now? Anyone want to venture a guess?
Speed of light.
Speed of light. What about it? You'd only get partial credit for that answer in my class, okay? And the midterm is coming up on Wednesday. So you're on the right track, but what about it? Haha, what's your name?
Joe.
Joe says we're seeing things that happened previously because what's your name? Gary said the speed of light basically is finite. It's not infinite, okay? So it takes time for light to travel from there to here. Fun fact to know and tell, light travels about a foot per nanosecond, about a foot per billionth of a second. You can say that at the next cocktail party to which you're invited, thus ensuring that you will never again be invited to a cocktail party. Okay. Anyway, so I'm seeing Joe there, not as he is right now, but as he was maybe 15 billionths of a second ago. He may not even exist anymore. Oh, he does. Good for him. He's still on this good earth. You see the sun as it was 8 1/3 minutes ago, because that's how long it takes for light to traverse 93 million miles. The typical stars you see with the naked eye at night are some tens or hundreds of light years away, in a few cases a thousand or so. So you're seeing them as they were tens, hundreds of years ago. And if you look at galaxies that are, say, a billion light years away and 4 billion light years away, and maybe that little blob there is 9 billion light years away, you're seeing them as they were 1, 4, 9 billion years ago. And encoded in the light is information about the expansion of the universe in those previous times. Indeed, the redshift keeps getting bigger and bigger is the point. Okay? Well, so we need distances. And the way we do it for nearby galaxies is pretty simple. And this is the technique Hubble used. We take pictures like this, and Hubble didn't have the Hubble Space Telescope, or at least it wasn't called that back then. I'm just joking. Anyway, it got launched in 1990 or so. In this picture, you can see individual stars. So let's call that one Gary, just for kicks. Okay? And let's say that we know that star is just like Betelgeuse here, a star in the constellation Orion, a big, bright, luminous, fantastic star. And we know the distance of the star. There are ways we can tell distances of nearby stars. And we know its apparent brightness. And so we can calculate its total oomph, its power, its luminosity. So if we know that this star here, Gary, is the same type of star, but it looks faint, we can figure out how far away it has to be to look that faint. And if we choose another star here, Brandon, let's say, and we get the same answer, then we start increasing our confidence that our technique is right. And indeed, Hubble used a type of star known as a Cepheid variable. It turns out they're quite powerful stars. So you use this technique all the time when you judge the distance of an oncoming car at night. You've looked at how bright the headlights are of a car of known distance, 6 feet away. Ooh, those are bright headlights. And then you look at fainter headlights, and your brain quickly does a calculation regarding how far away that car is based on the brightness of the headlights. It's almost intuitive, almost instinctive. I mean, if you're not very good at doing this very, really quickly, then you shouldn't be driving at night, okay? So cars, stars, it's the same sort of thing. We find stars whose true power we know. We measure their apparent brightness. We get their distance, all right? Now, that works for nearby galaxies quite well because you can see individual stars. But this galaxy that's, maybe 4 billion light years away, I don't see any individual stars there. They're too faint, and they can't be separated from their neighbors. But I need to know, is that galaxy 4 billion light years away, or pi billion light years away, or 4.5 billion light years away, right? How far away is it? So I need to see a star. But I can't see any regular stars. So it sounds like I'm done with this project. But there is, in fact, a type of star that you can see at great distances. Anyone want to venture a guess what kind of star that is? A type 1A supernova. Ooh, you know more than I was expecting, so you shouldn't leave the room. No. A supernova is an exploding star, and in particular, there's a so-called type 1A supernova, because there are different ways in which stars explode, and the type 1As are not only very luminous, but pretty standard. They all go off kind of in the same way. All right. So here's an exploding star. All right, there it is, and then it exploded. And such explosions can become millions or even billions of times brighter than our sun. Okay, in fact, here is a type 1A supernova, and I've sped things up. It takes a few weeks to brighten, but at its peak, right there, it's comparable to the central few billion stars in that galaxy. Now, if our sun were to do this, and it won't, then sunblock of 50 wouldn't help you, folks. You need sunblock or supernova block of a few billion. But don't worry, be happy. This isn't what our sun is going to do. It's going to die in a much more quiet way. Nevertheless, if we find these supernovae in galaxies whose distances we know, because we've measured stars like Brandon and Gary and others, then measuring the peak brightness and knowing the distance, we can calculate the luminosity. We can calibrate the headlight. So we have to first find them. And so I could have each of my students looking through a telescope at one and only one galaxy until he or she finds a supernova. Preferably they would look at night. You see more than stars and galaxies at night than during the day. But I would hang on to that student for decades, because typically a supernova goes off in a galaxy only once every 30 or 50 years. So I would have had decades worth of slave labor, and that would be such an egregious crime that even a tenured professor can and should get fired, right? Can't take advantage of students this way. But there's power in numbers, right? The more galaxies you look at, the greater are the odds that you'll find a supernova in some of them. So I could have my students looking at lots of galaxies, but, that would be kind of cruel too, because they need to sleep and they need to study and they need to party, So with today's modern technology, we have a better technique. We attach digital cameras to the back end of telescopes, take photographs of thousands of galaxies, and then simply look for arrows. And where we see arrows, we see exploding stars. You see, it worked once, twice, three times, four times, five times. By rigorous mathematical induction, I conclude that this process works every time. Well, it can't be that simple. Otherwise, again, we wouldn't give degrees for this kind of work. So what our team has done is developed a robotic telescope at Lick Observatory that automatically takes pictures of nearly 10,000 galaxies a week, over 1,000 a night, compares them automatically with the old pictures. Usually there's nothing new, but occasionally there's something new. Okay, and that gets flagged as a supernova candidate. And this was all magnificently programmed and set up by my associate, Weidong Li. The system works just beautifully. And so here's an example of a before and after picture of a galaxy where, here's the galaxy, and then suddenly there's this arrow here, which catches our attention. Well, okay, there's that thing there, and it's marked with an arrow. But, this isn't necessarily a supernova. There could be other things that could be, like an asteroid heading toward Earth, like that one a couple of weeks ago. Two in the same day, can you believe that? Anyway, so we have to screen these things and figure out which ones are likely to be true exploding stars. So out of 1,000 images per night, maybe 50 will show something potentially interesting, and they get flagged. And then I use undergraduate students who, with their superior eye-brain combination, look at the images and determine which ones are likely to be genuine supernovae and worthy of further study. And I know you're giggling at the fellow at the left there. I think he's the cosmetologist in our group, okay? So, and then I realize I teach at Berkeley, and this isn't all that uncommon. But these undergraduates, and in a few cases even high school students, get really early exposure to research. I take quite a number of freshmen and sophomores, okay? And they get really jazzed by it. They get real experience with research. And again, this is something that we do at Lick Observatory. We make Lick available for students to get hands-on research experience, which is, very difficult with something like the Hubble Space Telescope or the Keck telescopes, where every second is precious. And again, that's a really great reason to support friends of Lick Observatory. Anyway, even 20 years ago, we knew that a certain type of supernova, the so-called type 1As, I won't go into the jargon too much, but you can look them up if you want. Even 20 years ago, we knew already enough about them to know that they are useful cosmological yardsticks. They're powerful, they're pretty uniform, we calibrated some of them in nearby galaxies. Yes, in the past 20 years I've been using my robotic telescope with my team to refine the calibration, to make it even better. But even in the early 1990s we knew that these are the things we could find in very distant little blobs and try to determine the distances of those galaxies. So two teams set out to do this. They set out to find distant supernovae. And the distant supernovae are used to measure, number one, the distance to the galaxy in which it's located. Okay, you measure the apparent brightness, the true power. That then tells you the distance. Hence, it tells you how far back in time you're looking. And number two, the supernova can be used to measure the redshift due to the expansion of the universe, because we know what the spectrum of a nearby supernova looks like. And if it's been redshifted, we can measure that from the spectrum. Okay. So that's why it's very, important to to measure these supernovae. And both teams used big telescopes, primarily in the southern hemisphere, to take wide-angle pictures of the sky. By wide-angle, I mean roughly the size of the full moon. I know the full moon isn't rectangular in shape, but anyway, this is roughly the area of the moon. And in this picture, again, you see thousands of galaxies. There are very few stars in our own galaxy in this picture. So if you take many such pictures of the sky throughout the night, you will have taken the mugshot of perhaps 100,000 galaxies. If you repeat the process, the same fields in the sky, 3 weeks later, some of those 100,000 galaxies will have produced type 1a supernovae, even though this is a very rare phenomenon on a per-galaxy basis. If you have 100,000 galaxies, you know, you're going to find some of them. And we find them through digital subtraction. Here's part of one of these images taken on the 7th of April, then the 28th of April. We subtract this one from that one, get a bunch of noise. That's okay. Any measurement process necessarily has some noise associated with it. But here, cleverly placed in the middle of the square, is something that looks like it might be real and attracts our attention. And then a Hubble picture of it a few weeks later showed it as well. And you know it has to be a type 1a supernova because it's marked with an arrow. But it looked like it was brightening and fading in a manner consistent with a type 1a supernova. But the way to really be sure is to take a spectrum, this fingerprint. Okay, and that's what my job was on both teams. I'm a spectroscopist by training. I've studied supernovae for decades. I know about them quite a lot. And I have a lot of experience on big, huge telescopes, okay, like the Keck 10-meter telescopes in Hawaii, which are owned and operated cooperatively by the University of California and Caltech in Pasadena. So I would get spectra of the supernovae and the galaxies in which they're located. And when the spectra showed that we had a nice type 1A, a young one, well, then I was a very happy camper. Now you see the real reason we build observatories in Hawaii. You know, the water here in the Bay Area is a bit too cold for my taste. Okay, there are good scientific reasons as well. So here's the punchline. Here are three galaxies before and after a supernova was discovered. And these were spectroscopically confirmed as these type 1A supernovae. And the point is that they're faint. They're really, really faint. And you might say, well, they're in these scrawny, faint, pathetic-looking galaxies. Obviously, these are very distant galaxies, so these supernovae should be faint. And that's correct reasoning. But these guys are fainter than they had any right to be. They are so faint that they imply too large a distance given their redshift. And, you know, there's sort of a distance-redshift relationship when you deal with cosmological models. And depending on exactly what the universe has been doing, you expect supernovae having a particular redshift to be at a particular distance. And these guys were all farther away than expected. The way to tell this to your neighbor is the following. Suppose the universe were 1 second old, and I measure the distance of the apple from my hand after 1 second. Well, that's some distance, fine. But the Earth's gravity has been slowing down the apple. If Earth's mass were less, then for a given toss, the apple would go farther because it's slowing down less, right? Now, I can't make Earth's mass less, but I can do the equivalent thing. I can toss the apple faster, and you can see in 1 second it goes higher, okay? Now, get rid of the Earth entirely and forget about the Sun and Jupiter, everything else. If I toss the apple, does it have any reason whatsoever to slow down? No, that's just Newton's first law of motion, okay? There's no forces acting upon it. It'll just keep going with the same speed. So in 1 second, it'll get even farther, right, because it hasn't been slowed down. What we found was that the corresponding objects to the apples, the supernovae, and hence the galaxies in which they're located, were farther away than the maximum distance that they could have reached, even had they not been slowing down at all. So if they're not slowing down and if they're not moving at a constant speed, what's the logical alternative? They're speeding up, right. If I attach a rocket to this thing and it goes zoop, then it can get to a greater distance in 1 second. So that's the idea. We measured seemingly an acceleration rather than some value of the anticipated deceleration. We expected either strong deceleration in a universe that ends up in a big crunch or weak deceleration in a universe that expands forever. But no one in his or her right mind expected acceleration. So this was the shocking news. I was privileged for Schmidt's team to announce this at a meeting in L.A. Here's the headline that came out. Astronomers see a cosmic anti-gravity force at work. We use this term anti-gravity hesitantly because people ask us, can they use this stuff, whatever it is, and attach it to their cars and levitate over Bay Area traffic jams? And the answer is no. You cannot collect it. It's either a property of space itself, or it is so dilute and uncollectible that you'd have to go out, you know, many, many light years to get even a reasonable sample of it. So, you know, it's just not collectible. Nevertheless, it has this effect, okay? And that was in February of 98. People were very surprised, very skeptical, as they should be. Scientists are bred to be skeptical. But both teams made the announcement at about the same time. And so people really had to take notice because two very good teams came to the same conclusion. Perhaps both were flawed, but the odds of that are lower than when just one team announces something, okay? Well, there was a flurry of activity. People tried to disprove us, but by the end of 98, no one had shown any flaws in what we had done. So the editors of Science Magazine proclaimed this to be the single most important discovery in all areas of science that year. Now, the caricature of Einstein is surprised here, not because he's blowing multiple universes out of his pipe. You might not have known that there are multiple universes and that they come from the pipes of theoretical physicists. Well, the first part of that statement might be true. We are seriously considering the possibility of multiple universes now, but I don't think they come from pipes of theoretical physicists. Anyway, Einstein is surprised here because this one universe is expanding faster and faster with time, not more and more slowly as had been anticipated. This is hard to show in a single still image. He's doubly surprised because he has a sheaf of papers here where there's an equation. The Greek letter lambda equals 8 pi g, Newton's constant, times the density of the vacuum. And you might think, oh my goodness, the Commonwealth Club has sunk to new lows. They invited this bozo from Berserkly who's talking about the density of the vacuum. You were taught on your mother's knee that the vacuum is sheer emptiness, zilch, nada. How can it have a non-zero matter or energy density? Okay, mass per unit volume or energy per unit volume. Well, I'm just the messenger. Okay, this was Einstein's idea, and he was a lot smarter. So Einstein came up with this idea of an anti-gravity type effect in 1917 after developing his general theory of relativity, which is a more elaborate form of gravity than Newtonian physics. Okay, it actually gives you some idea of what actually causes gravity. All right. And, you know, as in Newtonian gravity, things pull. And so two galaxies should be pulling on one another. The universe should be collapsing in on itself, yet it didn't look like the sky was falling. The universe looked static. Einstein believed it was static. Most physicists at that time believed it was static, neither expanding nor collapsing. Okay? And this was considered a very aesthetically pleasing universe. However, to have this aesthetically pleasing universe, Einstein had to introduce what was to him a very displeasing effect, this cosmological constant, a force of unknown origin, with no physical evidence in any terrestrial laboratory, that acts in a direction opposite to that of gravity with exactly the same strength. So this upper arrow is exactly as big as this down arrow, and they balance out. So the net force is zero. It's like this apple. If my hand is pulling up on it with exactly the force with which gravity is pulling down, the net force is zero. It's stationary. Only if one or the other dominates does the apple accelerate. Okay? So, you know, they say, Lucas said, right, may the force be with you. No, may the net force be with you, right? The force may be with you, but if some other force is against you, you're going to lose, pal, okay? So may the net force be with you. Lucas needs to take a physics class. Okay, anyway, so Einstein introduced this, and he didn't like it because it seemed arbitrary. It seemed very finely tuned, these two arrows the same size. It implied that the density of the vacuum is non-zero, and it implied that whatever's in the vacuum has an intrinsically repulsive set of properties, and people found that repugnant, okay? Einstein, you know, introduced this. 12 years later, Hubble discovered that the universe isn't static after all. It's, you know, it's expanding. We don't know why it's expanding. It began with a Big Bang. That's a different question. But once you start the expansion, nothing else is needed to keep it going. So Einstein renounced the cosmological constant as having been the biggest blunder of his career. Had he not introduced it, he could have been famous, okay, right? He could have predicted that the universe is not static. So here he is, sad that he ever introduced the cosmological constant. Now, I don't know that that's what he's thinking, but it could be what he's thinking, you know. What have we done 12 years, the better part of a century later? We've reintroduced the idea not to have a static universe, but one which over the biggest distances, like 100 million light years and beyond, is accelerating. So here in this room, the down arrow dominates. In our solar system, down. In our galaxy, down. In our local group of galaxies, it's all down. But as you get to distances of like 100 million light years, and a light year is big, it's 6 million million miles, okay? As you get to truly big distances, the up arrow begins to dominate over the attractive effect of matter. And the universe accelerates in its expansion. So rather than being the biggest blunder of his career that Einstein thought this was, it may have been his biggest triumph, the idea of this repulsive effect. And the only blunder was the relatively minor blunder of, in a sense, arbitrarily setting the size of this arrow to be exactly the same as the size of that arrow. And, you know, unlikely situation, you know, given that there's no physical cause for this cosmological constant that Einstein could think of. So if Einstein were around right now, maybe he would have this reaction that's similar to the cover of Science magazine, you know, right? So what is the stuff? Well, it's not the visible matter of the universe, because all visible matter pulls. And some of you have heard of antimatter. Antimatter pulls also. And then there's this stuff called dark matter. You can see it here, here, here. No, there's a lot of dark matter in it. It helps bind clusters of galaxies together, and galaxies themselves are bound by dark matter. If there weren't this dark matter, things would just go flying apart. And yet we see lots and lots of clusters like this. So they're true, you know, groupings of galaxies. They're not just galaxies that happen to be passing each other in the night. They're physical entities. And so they're bound by this extra attraction, this dark matter that Brandon studied the growth of galaxies and stuff for his PhD thesis. So it can't be that. The stuff that's driving the universe apart in between the clusters of galaxies is something new. And for better or worse, it's called dark energy. Dark in the sense that we can't see it, doesn't emit light, like dark matter doesn't emit light. Also dark in the sense of mysterious. We don't know what it is, just like we don't actually know what dark matter is. We don't know what dark energy is. We know even less about dark energy than dark matter. But it's a bit of a troubling term, because there's an equation that I think all of you are familiar with, or at least have heard of. What's that equation? E equals mc squared. So I'm continually asked, are dark energy and dark matter really just equivalent things? And they're not. Dark energy pushes, dark matter pulls. And we don't know what dark energy is. But in honor of the Nobel Prizes, Noelle, my wife, came up with this t-shirt, Dark Energy is the New Black. And she even managed to get this t-shirt to the King of Sweden, so along with a $2 bill. Anyway, this stuff is important. Averaged over typical large volumes in the universe, take a billion light year sphere in diameter, okay? Add up all the matter and energy you can think of and you can measure. 74% of it in that sphere will be dark energy. Take any other sphere of that size, 74% of it will be dark energy. We don't know how big the universe is, okay? The reason I'm making this point is that after some of my talks, people have asked the very reasonable question, well, you don't know how big the universe is, so how can you say that 73% of it is dark energy? Take any big volume, 73% of that volume will be dark energy. This room is not a sufficiently big volume, okay? All right. Well, that's amazing, right? It's 73%. We don't know what it is. 23% is this dark matter. We don't know what that is. The part we know pretty well are the 4%. Okay, and only 0.4% of that is easily visible in the form of stars and planets which reflect starlight. Most of the other stuff is this intergalactic gas whose presence was assumed but not actually shown definitively until relatively recently. So atoms are this stuff. Well, you know, we're the debris of the universe, the afterthought of creation. That's not to say you're not important. You are to your loved ones, your friends, your family. But you're not made of the dominant stuff of the universe. The dominant stuff is the dark energy followed by dark matter. And we don't know what they are. Okay, so for the youngsters here, there's an amazing opportunity, right? If you figure out what these things are, I mean, you know, Nobel Prize, women, money, all kinds of things. So anyway, the other reason it's important is that this is thought to be a quantum effect, an effect on the very small scales that ends up being everywhere, and so it actually dominates the large-scale behavior of the universe. And so as such, it provides perhaps a clue to the much sought-after quantum theories of gravity, okay? String theories or candidate theories, okay? But you want to unify the physics of the very small, quantum physics, and the physics of the very large masses, okay? They work very, very well alone. But when you try to bring them together, you get complete disagreement. They're at war with one another. And this is a highly unsatisfactory situation in physics right now. So we want a quantum theory of gravity. Dark energy perhaps provides a clue to quantum theory of gravity. I should be fair and say that one additional possible interpretation of the acceleration is that Einstein's general theory of relativity does not work on large scales. But that would be a very exciting conclusion as well, and equally revolutionary. Most theorists seem to prefer a new component of stuff in the universe, this dark energy. They prefer that over a failure of general relativity, because general relativity is just so incredibly beautiful. But it could be wrong. You know. Anyway, this is, you know, the nature of what's going on is by many physicists considered to be the single most important observationally motivated problem in all of physics today, the origin and nature of dark energy, followed by the origin and nature of dark matter. So, you know, coming to an end now, how will the universe end? You know, well, what we thought in 2001 when this was written and, you know, was that this dark energy, whatever it is repulsive, and it'll keep on spreading the universe apart faster and faster with time. Because as the galaxies move away from each other, the repulsive effect actually becomes stronger because the gravitational attraction between the galaxies weakens, okay? And this effect actually becomes stronger over bigger distances. So we thought there would be a runaway universe, one that's accelerating faster and faster with time. So if you want to see galaxies with your very own eyes through a telescope, you'd better go to your local observatory or planetarium or Lick Observatory this summer. We have a summer visitors program. Do it sometime soon, because within a few tens of billions of years, those galaxies will have been whisked away to such great distances that no telescope will be able to see them. And, you know, so all you'll see are the stars in the sky. There won't be other galaxies to be seen with big telescopes. So we thought that the universe would expand forever. However, theorists at Stanford and elsewhere have pointed out that given that we don't know what the dark energy is, it is conceivable, and indeed there are reasonable physical models for this, that its sign will change in the future from one of repulsion, which is currently the case, to gravitational attraction. This could happen. And if there's enough dark energy, and we're not quite sure if there's just barely enough or just barely too little, but if there's enough, then after it changes sign, the universe will slow down, eventually come to a halt, and then recollapse in on itself. So I cannot tell you definitively that the universe will expand forever. I think the odds are that it will, but I cannot, I wouldn't bet my house on it. Actually, maybe I would, because I just rent, and so it's not a big bet for me. But anyway, so I can't tell you exactly how it'll end. Well, Frost did not know about anti-gravity and dark energy, but he was at least sufficiently well-educated to know that the universe can have two endings. Collapse, the big crunch, the gnab-gib, ending hot, like fire, and eternal expansion, ending dark and dilute and cold, like ice. Because he had this poem, right? Fire and ice. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. So you see, Frost would prefer this type of a universe, the one that ends in fire. But if the universe and he had to perish twice, then eternal expansion and an ending in ice would be okay with him. And that's perhaps appropriate given his name, Robert Frost. Thank you very much for your attention. And it looks like we have some time for questions. And then for a few minutes afterwards, I'll hang around to answer some additional ones if you have them. Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Alex. Mm-hmm. First, I wanted to remind our listening audience that this has been a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you've been listening to Dark Energy and the Runaway Universe with Professor Alex Filipenko. I'd like to open the floor up right now for questions. I'll be running around with the mic, so please don't ask your question until you have the mic, all right? So let's start up here up front.
Does this same theory apply to atoms?
Does the same theory apply to atoms? Interesting question. We actually think that the dark energy is everywhere, including inside atoms, but it is not strong enough to spread atoms apart. Okay, it's not even strong enough to spread clusters of galaxies apart. Okay? So there's just not enough of it. However, there is a theoretical possibility. It's not a super strong possibility in reality, in my opinion, but it's nevertheless a theoretical possibility that the dark energy could become stronger with time, per unit volume. In that case, someday it'll be strong enough to tear apart clusters of galaxies, then it'll tear apart galaxies, then it'll tear apart planetary systems, then stars, planets, us, and even our atoms. This is known as the Big Rip, as opposed to the Big Chill, which is just the regular acceleration. I don't think the Big Rip is going to happen, but it is a theoretical possibility.
I'm trying to understand the thread of logic that gets you to the dark energy.
Right.
It seems that you're observing these faraway galaxies that are demonstrating this acceleration. They're further out than where they should be.
That's correct.
Yet, what if on a larger cosmic scale that curve of gravitational attraction doesn't go at a slope that would be expected? Maybe there's a drop off at a substantially large distance. So what you're seeing is galaxies that have gone beyond that threshold of attraction to other galaxies, and that inherent energy is just, they just suddenly are ripping in, like as if they got through the goo and now they're unhindered.
Right.
And now you're interpreting that.
Yeah. No, it's a reasonable possibility. The answer to that is that when we look to the very largest distances, we see a very uniform universe, homogeneous, same average density over big scales, and isotropic. That is, no matter which direction we look, we see the same thing. And in particular, we see this as far back as we can see, to a time when the universe was only 380,000 years old and it emitted what's now called the cosmic microwave background radiation. And that was really very, very uniform, aside from tiny little lumps, which are good for us because galaxies and clusters of galaxies grew from them. So given that from the very beginning we see this very, very uniform universe, there would have been no reason for there to be concentrations of matter or edges beyond which these galaxies have gone within the visible part of the universe to which we've seen these supernovae. Because we've looked much beyond the supernovae and still have remarkable evidence for this uniformity, this incredible uniformity of the universe. So I would say that's my answer to that. And the observation, yeah, we've found supernovae in many different directions as well, and they're all doing the same thing at about that with the same distance redshift relationship, no matter which direction we look, you know. So, yeah.
Okay.
Right. So let me repeat that because you didn't have a microphone, and maybe for the recording we need that. The question was, you know, if you have this like rubber band, and remarkably enough, I brought a rubber band. By the way, the Big Rip, technically speaking, would only occur if the dark energy became stronger with time per unit volume, and we don't think that's going to happen. But the Big Chill, this accelerating expansion, yeah, it goes like that. It's not going to rip apart space, it's just going to make space bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's going to make the distances between galaxies arbitrarily large. Then you asked about other universes. There could well be other universes that do a similar thing. Or there could be universes where their dark energy doesn't do this, but rather is the attractive kind. There is that theoretical possibility, and those universes might expand only for a short time and then recollapse. And you know, we don't live in one of those universes because there's not enough time for life and complexity to have developed. But it is possible that there are many, many different types of universes out there, and ours is just one of the rare ones in which conditions are such that we could exist. If the universe recollapses too fast, we couldn't exist. Turns out if it expands too quickly, we also couldn't exist because galaxies and stars wouldn't have come together if matter got spread apart. So in a sense, we expected this cosmological constant. If it's non-zero, we expected it to at least be small. And indeed it is. It's not a big number, but it's not zero either.
So. All right. And for a brief 5 microseconds, you talked about quantum effects within the environment of a vacuum.
Yeah.
Would that be called vacuum energy?
Yeah, vacuum energy. And by the way, I forgot to mention that because of time constraints and all that, I only talked about our research, the supernovae. But the reason this is now taken very seriously by nearly everyone is that there are many other different types of observations that support our original conclusion. If it were only the supernovae, we wouldn't have got the Nobel Prize. But there's other confirming evidence now. Okay, so this vacuum energy is precisely what I'm talking about.
Okay, could you elaborate on that?
So if this dark energy is the so-called cosmological constant, then it corresponds to what can be thought of as the vacuum energy of space itself. And to be brief, quantum physics actually predicts that the universe's vacuum cannot be the classical boring nothingness that you may have been taught early on your mother's knee. That was not an unreasonable thing to be taught, but quantum mechanics tells us that that can't be. Because if it were boring and always the same, we would know the energy of every point in space for all of time. It would be either 0 or 5 or pi or something like that, whatever it is, okay? And it turns out that that's fundamentally incompatible with something known as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And the way the uncertainty principle prevents you from knowing the energy of every point in space at all times is that the energy is continually fluctuating. And the process by which it can do that is that it forms particle-antiparticle pairs out of nothing. They're called virtual particles, and they exist for a very short time. They actually violate the law of conservation of energy for a very short time consistent with quantum physics. So that's okay. You can violate classical physics. So they come from nothing. They exist for a little while, and then they're back to nothing again. And so that would be this dark energy. Now, when you do a so-called back-of-the-envelope calculation, when theorists do this, they come up with a number that's so incredibly large for the natural amount of this stuff that it would have blown us apart long ago, and we wouldn't even actually exist. The cosmological constant should be 10 to the 120th power, and we measure 0.7 in the same units, 0.73 in particular, okay? So that's the biggest error ever in theoretical physics, okay? So people say, okay, there's some reason that we don't quite yet understand, and this is what I was taught for 2 decades, that all the fluctuations somehow cancel out, that in a sense they're positive energy fluctuations, but also there are negative energy fluctuations. And there's ways to do this within string theory and stuff. And so physicists said, we don't yet know exactly how it happens, but it must be that there's a cancellation and the vacuum energy is zero. And that's what they thought for decades, without actually having a mechanism. Well, what we found is that if the vacuum fluctuations are what the dark energy is, and that's still a big if, then it must mean that there's a slight imbalance between the positive energy fluctuations and the negative energy ones. An imbalance at the level of 1 part per 10 to the 120th, which is almost inconceivable how you actually achieve that in nature, which is why most theoretical physicists actually don't like the cosmological constant. So they come up with other schemes to try to explain the dark energy. They go by quintessence and other kinds of things. But right now the data are compatible with the simplest possibility, this cosmological constant. And so if it's true, it means there's some mystical, I don't want to call it mystical or magical because that's anti-science, but there's still a not understood mechanism by which the fluctuations don't perfectly cancel out. And that would be then what this dark energy is. Yeah. Good question. That's why the answer was long. Oops, sorry. Yes.
Yeah, does string theory have anything to offer by way of suggestion about the nature of dark energy and dark matter, or is it just confined to the forces?
Yeah, it sure does. And I need to tell you an anecdote. In 1998 and early 99, when we were first presenting this work at various conferences of physicists and astrophysicists, I distinctly remember giving a talk where I presented our results, and a very famous string theorist said, "You observational astronomers are wasting giant amounts of precious Hubble Space Telescope and Keck Observatory time because what you found must be a mistake. There is no way in principle even that the universe can be doing this, accelerating." And I said, "Why not?" He says, "Because they have no physical explanation for it." I said, "Well, so what, you know?" And then he said, "Well, and there's no conceivable explanation ever." And I'm all, "Well, gee whiz, dude, you know, I mean, I'm only an observational astronomer. I know which end of the telescope to look through, and I'm going to keep on trying to confirm this effect using our better observations, and colleagues of mine will use techniques in which they have very highly honed skills, okay? And we'll either be wrong or right. I hope we're right, but if we're wrong, I hope we're wrong for a subtle reason that ends up telling us something interesting about the universe, not 2 plus 2 equals 5. That is a programming error. That would be a huge embarrassment, okay? And I said, but if we end up being right, I have no doubt that clever young whippersnappers will come up with not one explanation, but at least several possible explanations, okay? And he said, well, string theory says there's only one possible kind of universe, and we haven't figured it out yet, but there's only one. Fast forward 15 years, okay? They now, in modern string theory, admit that there's what's called a landscape of at least 10 to the 500 power universes. By the way, that's a really big number. Do you know how many particles of all kinds there are within our observable universe that extends 14 billion light years in all directions? Only 10 to the 80th. Okay? So 10 to the 500 is a really big number, okay? And so they call this the landscape. And in this landscape, there are certain things that are fundamental, various laws of physics, okay? But there are certain things that could have had, they're just sort of, they're kind of random. They're relatively uninteresting details of exactly how the universe evolved. A little bit like, you know, snowflakes all have a hexagonal symmetry if they're not hassled when they're being formed. But no two snowflakes look alike because of the exact motions and locations of the water molecules when they began to crystallize there, okay? So you can have these universes that satisfy laws of physics, but the laws themselves, or at the very least, the physical constants might differ in this landscape of universes. And then what explains the wonderful properties of the universe in which we live, where, by the way, if you change not just the cosmological constant, but many, many other things, if you change really boring-sounding things like the relative masses of the proton and neutron, you might think, what is the most boring thing you can think of in the universe? It's the relative mass of the proton and neutron. No, it's not boring at all. It turns out if it were a little bit different, the only stable atoms would be helium or hydrogen or iron or something, you know. So there are many things, if you changed them ever so slightly, we would live in a very boring universe. So one explanation for the very rich, complex universe in which we live is that it's one of the rare ones where conditions are conducive to the development of complexity. And so the string theorists would say that we live in one of the universes where the cosmological constant is not so big that we would have been blown apart, on the one hand, but a value of zero, on the other hand, is extraordinarily unlikely, because out of the real number line, the number zero is a very rare number, right? So you expect a small positive cosmological constant, and that's what the string theorists are now saying. And some of them even say that, well, we predicted that. That's revisionist history. They post-dicted that, okay?
All right. Please join me in thanking Alex again.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating 109th year of enlightening discussion, is adjourned.
Very good. All right. Excellent.